CBS News Special Report. Hurricane Melissa is now a Category 3 storm, still extremely dangerous with 125 mile-per-hour winds. The damage in Jamaica is said to be extensive. CBS's Jason Allen is in Kingston.
We've seen roofs flapping since early this morning, so I imagine the closer you get to center, there are likely places where there are entire structures that are gone.
When it made landfall earlier today, it was a Category 5, one of the strongest hurricanes to ever make landfall in the Atlantic. Aretha Taylor described the conditions a few hours ago when she was riding out the storm in Ocho Rios.
A lot of winds, heavy, heavy winds, not too much rain, but the winds are coming in.
CBS News New York chief weathercaster Lonnie Quinn on Melissa's path to Cuba overnight.
It wants to emerge from Cuba as a Cat 3, and by the time we get into Wednesday, it's approaching the Bahamas. Category 3 storm is a major hurricane.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Stacey Lynn.
Not just headlines, insight. Not just noise, conversation. 540 WAUK is your home for real news and great conversation in Milwaukee.
Bucks basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. NBA, the Bucks are at home tonight against the New York Knicks. Both teams with records of 2-1. The Bucks coming off a loss on the road to Cleveland. Giannis Antetokounmpo.
I think it says a lot. The Cavs had the best record last year. They're one of the best teams in the East. Nothing's guaranteed. Nothing is given. They have to prove themselves.
Baseball, game 3 of the World Series lasted 18 innings. The most since the World Series in 2018 when Freddie Freeman hit a home run in the 18th to lead the Dodgers to a win over the Red Sox. Last night, it was Freeman again, this time against the Blue Jays on Fox Sports.
Freeman sends a fly ball to center field. Varsho's going back before the clock strikes midnight. Freddie Freeman has ended it. It's a repeat hero and a Game 3 classic.
The Dodgers winning 6-5. Game 4 is tonight in L.A. The Dodgers up 2-1 with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Matt Nair on air.
Attorney General Pam Bondi said that they had arrested the girlfriend of the head of Antifa. Troy from Mount Horeb is on the line. Good morning, Troy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I am the head of Antifa.
You are?
And yes, and I think my wife turned in my girlfriend. So,
oh, you're in trouble now, Troy.
Matt Nair on air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Real news, great conversation from Milwaukee and beyond. 540 WAUK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about on Sunday. Joe Biden got an award at the Edward M. Kennedy Institute there in Boston, Lifetime Achievement Award. Said that, hey, we're in tough times. He said these are dark days, made it very clear. How do you put it? There's no sugarcoating the situation that we're in as Trump and the Republicans are testing the limits of power and attacking free speech and doing all the stuff. And Biden took the time to remind us as Americans that, well, this country is stronger than any dictator, any wannabe authoritarian, and that as a country, we have faced tough times before. We have. He said for 250 years, the country has been engaged in a constant fight between peril and possibility. And I agree with him. And this is why, you know, I have friends who are like, you know, aren't you freaked out? I'm going, yeah, things are going to get bad. You got to prepare for it. You got to get ready for the horrible to happen because it's going to. The reality is we've got millions of working families who are at risk of losing crucial health care subsidies that were put in place by Joe Biden during the pandemic to help people. These subsidies made health insurance a little bit more affordable for working class people. This is why it's amazing to me that I hear working people, well, they're going to shut down the government for that. Yeah, that means you too. And understand, you know, states, their subsidies are going to skyrocket. The cost of insurance across the board is going to skyrocket in a lot of places, well over 100%. And what this means is folks like you and me, hardworking people who go to work every day, going to lose coverage or pay thousands more. Something Biden warned about as part of the ongoing government shutdown fight. And despite all this, you know, Joe Biden urged us to not give up or check out. And this is what I've been saying. You can't turn away. You got to go right through the horrible. He believes America will come out stronger, wiser, and, well, in his words, more just if we just keep fighting and standing together. And I agree with him. He sees ordinary Americans, like late-night TV hosts and comedians, standing their ground and shining lights on the threats that are coming, the threat to free speech. This really a call to all working-class Americans. Stay hopeful, stay united, and as I've been saying, stay prepared, get prepared to fight for the rights that we still kind of have, and get ready for the future dark days that are coming. It's the reality. So while the former president's out there cheerleading the current president, well, we've got their Department of Labor. And I just saw some of the creepiest stuff out of our Department of Labor and their Project Firewall, which they say is a major enforcement initiative that's going to curb the abuses of H-1B visas. And look, I think something has to be done. I'm all in favor of doing something on that front. And I'm not totally opposed to going after people who violate wage, under paying people not enough wages, displace U.S. workers, fraudulently apply for these programs. I'm not against this stuff. But it's the way that they put it out with these weird, creepy kind of Americans first, 1950s, white supremacist, meet Norman Rockwell paintings of, you know, restoring the American dream with a bunch of white people in churches. It's just kind of bizarre. And look, I'm somebody who 100% believes in fighting for the American dream, fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, all of those things. And yet I see our Department of Labor in this weird kind of creepy move that I can only say is in their hands going to assault the abused and leave the abusers alone. And where I separate from Lori Chavez DeRemer's Department of Labor and the goals of this, because I'm not, again, like I said, not against the idea of what's laid out so much as I am, I know how they're going to use it, because this is a historic joint operation between the Department of Labor, the Department of Justice, the EEOC, immigrations, the ICE people, all of that sharing information. Now, do you think they're going to go after the people in the images? Again, the creepy, weird kind of images of an America that I don't know really ever was. And I know they're hoping we go back to in some weird kind of way. But I got to tell you, it's, I guess, look it up. The Department of Labor's Project Firewall. Very strange. Now, on the other side of this, Lori Chavez DeRemer is going to have a lot of power to be able to initiate investigations. And I'm sure that will not be done for political purposes. And I'm sure it's not going to be to shake people down to get the $100,000 for an HB1 visa. I'm sure it's not going to be that. But they're going to target certain industries, healthcare being part of it. And this is, again, the weird part of this. We've sought employers and workers from out of the country to fill jobs here because, well, we don't have enough. And we're not spending enough money on education, I don't think, to get people into those positions. So we're really, in a weird way, kind of screwing ourselves over. Come to me with a plan on how we're going to get people the skills and the ability to do all this. Corporations may be going back to training workers. Great. But I fear this is just another in the, we're going to go after those people and use this Project Firewall as a way to go after the already abused and allow the abusers to continue on the way. So it's going to be interesting to see it play out, but I want to hear your thoughts on the creepy, weird imagery, especially coming from someone named Lori Chavez de Reamer. Just weird. But again, look, they put that giant Trump picture on the Department of Labor, so why am I shocked? Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I go back to this Project Firewall, which, you know, the images, again, I can't look at these images and not just think, you know, what world are these people living in? Look, I'm all in favor of fighting for the American dream. I'm all in favor of, you know, better wages, hours, conditions. But wow, to have the U.S. Department of Labor come out with these really creepy kind of throwback 40s, 50s, very, very white kind of images, I guess speaks volumes to who they are and what they see as the what their mission is. But also, you know, kind of tipping their hands on who they're going after with this Project Firewall. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, what all of this looks like, especially in the labor world, I've asked my good friend Eric Loomis to come share some thoughts. Eric is a historian, author, and blogger over at Lawyers, Guns, and Money blog. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Always happy to. Thank you, Rick.
So, you know, you look at these images that I showed, and let me ask you, you know, flat out, what pops up in your head? What grabs you by the gut? What do you think?
Well, it shows that this administration, including this Department of Labor, only really cares about white people, and a very particular kind of very Anglo-Saxon looking white person. You know, as you point out, these images are painfully white, and, you know, I mean, a lot about Trumpism generally is this nostalgia for what they see as the 1950s or 40s. And, you know, that didn't actually exist in the 1940s and 50s, you know, like nostalgia is not a real vision of the past. It's a romanticized vision of the past. And it's very clear, as you see through this project and other things the Trump administration and different agencies is pointing out, is they are really trying to embrace a white supremacist past for a white supremacist future. You know, there's really no room for not only African-Americans, but Latinos, including, you know, the Latinos who voted for Trump. There's not a vision of them in this future that they are very clearly representing in these weird images. And, you know, the other thing worth noting is that these images coming out of the Department of Labor really don't even have anything to do with work. Like, right. One of them has a polluting factory in the background, as if the polluting factory was some wonderful relic of the past that we need to reiterate today. But most of these have nothing to do with work at all. It's just white people in some kind of fifth-rate version of a Norman Rockwell painting, like being their idealized American. Anybody who is not that person, beware, because they're telling you that you have no place in their country.
It's interesting you went to the Norman Rockwell thing, because my first thought was, is this an AI version of Norman Rockwell meets white supremacy? Is that this? And that's the you went right there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is. The irony is that Rockwell, in many ways, was quite progressive, had famous paintings that, you know, attacked racism, attacked segregated schools, and other things like this that are mostly forgotten about today. Like Norman Rockwell is supposed to represent this idealized past, but that's not really who he was, right? Even back at the time, sure, he was painting things about families and churches and this sort of thing, but you know, he often got into the great complexity of the present. And the paintings, as they were seen at the time, were not some throwback to some mythical past, but rather were dealing in a kind of a populist way with the great complexities of the time in which he lived in. So, yeah, it's trying to be what they think Norman Rockwell was, but just producing, like everything in Trump world, a really cheap, crappy version of it.
Yeah, and the thing that's weird to me is you've got someone like Lori Chavez de Remer, who is the face of this, the one pushing this as Secretary of Labor. And again, as you pointed out, it's not really about work, but pushing this agenda that I view, and maybe it's just the way I'm looking at this administration and what they're doing, where I'm not 100% opposed to the mission. It's how they're going to use it that I'm most concerned with, which means they're going to go after the abusers and not the abused. Or I mean, they're going to go after the abused and not the abusers.
Yeah, this is the thing about Trumpism generally and this entire administration and everything Trump has stood for his entire life. I mean, remember, this is a man whose father's fortune was built on excluding black people from housing, right? I mean, one of the very first cases to fight a housing segregation after the passage of key civil rights laws was against Fred Trump. And everything Donald Trump has ever learned in his entire life is to be the bully. And, you know, obviously this has worked for him. I mean, it seems to be effective with too big of a swath of Americans who like to be on the bully side. And, you know, in the case of work, you have all kinds of people, and some of them are listening to your show, who have not been treated well on the job. And Donald Trump's response to this and Lori Chavez demeanor's response to it is not to fight for the worker. It is to say that it is to promote some kind of weird vision of the past in which the worker evidently doesn't even really exist and sort of subsumes themselves inside of this white supremacist shell for larger, you know, right wing, far right fascist ends. And so whether it's siding consistently with employers, whether it's Donald Trump's, you know, Donald Trump is already the greatest union buster in American presidential history, although it hasn't really affected his, you know, his right. Is the parts of the labor movement that are his friends, et cetera, et cetera. And this is bullies all the way down.
Yeah, no, I've said a bunch of times, you know, there was a movement of a concern of one is a concern of all, or an injury to one being an injury to all. What happens when a million people are injured as he has taken collective bargaining rights away from, what, a million federal workers?
Yeah, I mean, it demonstrates that Donald, this makes Ronald Reagan with the air traffic controllers look like FDR. I mean, it's that bad. He's by far the worst union buster in all of American history. And he has received zero pushback on this from the Republican Party, which is why it's so concerning that you have unions not only still supporting Trump, but supporting Republican candidates and thing, you know, over the all-time Senate champion of workers, Sherrod Brown, trying to reclaim a Senate seat in Ohio and promoting Republicans who will do nothing for them at all. Who will be completely anti-workers' rights and unions on every single thing. But sadly, I think what we're seeing from some unions is that they don't actually believe in solidarity. They don't believe that an injury to one is an injury to all. These things mean nothing to them. They are looking out strictly in what they perceive as their self-interest, which in this case is not economic self-interest, but a retrograde cultural self-interest about being, you know, white men in charge of the world and, you know, and siding with the boss, which is what they're siding with the boss consistently. And because it makes them feel good as white men. I think it's a sad state of affairs in this country today. Certainly not in all of the labor movement, but in parts of it.
No, what scares me the most, and I look at my union, I've been a Teamster for the better part of 35 years. The president of my union, Sean O'Brien, is resurrecting the worst parts of business unionism, in my view, where it's all just transactional. This idea that he thinks he's going to be able to move some Republicans, and maybe we're going to get something out of this Faster Labor Contract Act. I don't see it happening, but maybe. I hope it happens. But this idea that it's all transactional, that kind of just neuters the labor movement, doesn't it?
Well, it does, especially when you're not going to get anything out of it, right? The only way you're going to get those laws is through electing more Democrats and better Democrats, not just more Democrats, but better Democrats. There's not a single person, not a single Republican in the House and Senate who has lifted the first finger for the American working class. And that includes frauds like Josh Hawley, who like to, you know, give a word about this and that, but don't actually do anything about it, including consistently voting for judges who will overturn any kind of labor law, right? I mean, the future of the National Labor Relations Act is in extreme jeopardy, and Hawley has voted for the judges who are going to gleefully gut that law. Voting for people throughout the Department of Labor and other relevant agencies who are completely anti-union, destroying the National Labor Relations Board. And with no evidence that any of this legislation is ever even going to get close to passing. And so it's both sad in that it's rejuvenating a kind of cut rate transactional unionism, but it's also pathetic in that it's a completely failed strategy that has zero chance of succeeding.
No, and I look at these images again. The president of my union, Sean O'Brien, put a lot of political capital into getting Lori Chavez Dreamer put. He is the reason she's the Secretary of Labor. That I give him credit for that. He got what he wanted. Whatever it is he had to sacrifice, he had to bend whatever knee, give whatever speech or whatever thumbs up. He got what he wanted, but. All we've got so far are these weird, creepy kind of images that are kind of I come back to creepy and weird.
Yeah, and you know, all as far as I can tell, Lori Chavez Dreamer is one of the weakest people in the entire Trump cabinet. She hasn't said the single first thing that I can tell that's pro-worker in any way. She's mostly known in my world anyway, being from originally from Oregon, where she's from, is openly calling for Trump to send the military in to occupy Portland, right? I don't know how that's supporting the working class. You know, she hasn't have any sway within the Trump administration. You know, if she did, you might see Trump executive orders that are promoting the labor movement, right? But instead, what has her response been to a million workers losing their collective bargaining rights? Zip, nothing. Right? What has Sean O'Brien's response been to a million people losing their union rights? He evidently doesn't care. And I just have to believe he doesn't believe in solidarity.
Now, this is most certainly an interesting moment that we're in. And you brought up, you know, soldiers into Portland. One of the things that I said to, especially to my union brothers and sisters is, you know, hey, don't be too gleeful that they're going after the frogs and the plushies and furries, because the next time you go on strike, you might be met with the National Guard on your picket line.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that, you know, this is, you know, you're going to arrest or whatever a few hippies and deport a bunch of immigrants and this is all going to go away, I think, is a pipe dream, right? The idea here is to use police forces to be a personal occupying army of Donald Trump or whoever replaces Donald Trump into the future. And, you know, you don't have to be any kind of college professor or whatnot like myself to be able to simply read what these Republicans say about both the use of the military and labor and union rights to realize that they don't believe in unions in any way, shape, or form. They think unions are awful. They are completely pro-corporation. And they're going to use that. They're going to use those police forces for whatever disturbance or made up disturbance that they want. I mean, the whole thing in Portland, there's not even any real disturbance in Portland, right? Right. There's like a few protesters at an ICE location that's like, you know, on the edge of town. That's the entirety of it.
And
right?
Look, and what I saw is ICE is the one who escalates all this by throwing tear gas in there. And so as the guy who literally wrote the book, History of America in 10 Strikes, you know, as you look to your research and you look to the things that you've done, where do you see parallels of where we're heading and where we are? Do you see anything?
No, I think this is new, actually. I think this is new and worse. I mean, yeah, Donald Trump's the greatest union buster in American history. Now, this far right stuff has been around for a long, long time, right? I mean, you can go back and say, oh, you know, this is kind of like how the Ku Klux Klan was in the 1920s. Or the John Birch Society in the 1950s or other far-right organizations. The difference is they never took power, right? The difference is they were sort of co-opted by larger movements, right? Like, so people like, you know, Ronald Reagan, let's say, co-opted the far-right stuff of the 1950s and 60s and kind of made it sort of a junior part of his broader coalition. But, you know, in, by comparison to Trump, Reagan, unless you were a member of the air traffic controllers or Central American or an AIDS victim, you know, there were certain groups that he oppressed horribly, but it was nothing like this in a general sense, right? This is far, Trump is far, far, especially Trump too, is far, far worse than Reagan's worst nightmare, right? And so the difference is that in the past, these far right movements were kind of brought into the government in kind of junior ways. Today, they control the government. And the crazier you are, the more power you have in the Trump administration. So people who 5 years ago were just like, had like 1,000 followers on Twitter or something, are now running major agencies in the federal government, right? Simply because they're lunatics. So no, this is unprecedented. This is worse. I mean, this is arguably, I don't think there's any question about it. This is the worst moment in this country since the Civil War.
So is there any, you know, as a historian, you know, as you're painting a pretty bleak picture, is there hope?
Of course there's hope, right? I mean, but it would help a lot if the Teamsters and some of the other building trades actually figured out what solidarity means. I mean, a lot of this stuff that's happening are not things that people actually want, right? They're, you know, the term they like to use is flooding the zone, right? Doing a million things at once so that, you know, they keep on the offensive and nobody has time to react to any of it. But they don't want this, right? I mean, like everyday people do not want most of these things. And, you know, so there's absolutely hope. You just have to get out and organize and build on the things that are happening. I mean, there are positive things happening, you know, the No Kings protest. I don't know what that's going to lead to, but it's useful to get a lot of people in the streets. Certainly in Trump's first term, there were major actions that made a major difference, such as the Women's March or the rushing of the airports at the beginning of his administration when they issued the Muslim ban, and that forces them into some sense of retreat or retrenchment, at least for a little while. I mean, people in the streets, people voting, people organizing, people using the power that they have to actually work with other people to fight against this stuff, it can all be defeated and reversed. But so long as there are all of these people in the broader area of society, whether we're talking about business leaders who once might have played as being moderate and now going to the far right, or we're talking about the Teamsters, right? Who seem to think of this stuff in their interest. So long as they're giving cover for the rise of this extremism taking over the federal government, it's going to be very, very difficult to get the energy and power together to turn it around. And so, you know, I think that in the future, if historians still exist, I think a lot of people today who think of themselves as being real smart are going to be the villains, right? They're going to be the people that future Sean O'Brien is going to be a person that future Americans will revile as a class traitor.
Wow.
That is my historical thing. This is how we think about people who sided with far-right figures, sided with the Ku Klux Klan, made special behind-the-scenes deals to sell out other workers. He can recover his reputation, but I mean, I think future historians are going to look at people like this and think that they were some very, very bad human beings.
Interesting. I got to get your thought on this last bit. I'm sure you've seen the story of North Mag-a-Lago, the gold-plated ego palace, or the bigly tremendous ballroom of self-love. I'm sure you know I'm talking about the ballroom that's being built. With no regard for history, just one person's ego, the place where liberty meets gaudy, lavish excess. I got to get your thoughts on the ballroom.
Well, I mean, I think in the larger scheme of everything Trump's doing, there are certainly worse things that he's done. But I mean, it's a sign of just Donald Trump is the biggest ego ever. I mean, the man thinks of nobody but himself, and this is just the prime act, right? This is, in a sense, why the No Kings protests resonate and also angers him and his supporters so much, because he is so clearly acting like a king. He sees himself as a king. He sees himself as holding power. I think he's clearly going to – I think it's extremely likely that he's going to try to break the Constitution and run again in 2028. Whether he's able to or not, I don't know. But I think he's clearly going to try to do so. And this is just a symbol of – you know, the way he sees himself, which is as some sort of God king, and us as his subjects who should be following every whim that he has. And, you know, if that includes paving the White House in gold and turning it into Mar-a-Lago, well, you know what? This is what America voted for.
Here we are. And as I said, I've said before, it's got to get really, really bad before Americans wake up. The old labor frame of, you know, stomachs have to be empty before heads get right. I sadly feel it's got to get much worse. But Eric, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Always happy to be here. Thanks very much.
Good stuff. Our good friend Eric Loomis. Make sure you check out his book, the most important book ever written for working class people, and that is A History of America in 10 Strikes. Highly, highly suggested. Want to hear your thoughts. Is he right? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Milwaukee's Real News and Great Conversation, 540 WAUK.
Stay connected to the stories shaping your community and Wisconsin. Listen to it all right here on 540 WAUK and on the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A partly cloudy sky tonight, little breezy with lows in the mid-40s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny. The wind stays up at times, highs into the low 50s. And on Thursday, more sunshine, highs into the mid-50s. Maybe a shower late. Right now, it's 50.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
What is your favorite or least favorite word? Cinnamon. Love that word. And it's a superfood. I don't like the word buttress just because I'm immature. Pecan.
My favorite word is scoundrel. I would also say buttocks.
I said buttress and you said buttocks. John in Madison says words with silent letters bug me too. Pneumonia. Dumb. Funny because my name is John.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I was flipping through the wasting time, flipping through the videos, which I know I shouldn't, but it is addicting. You know, you go through the reels or the threads or the whatever the heck they are. In fact, the weird thing is I don't even know most of the time. And I know I sound really old saying this, but I don't even know which they are most of the time. But there's my governor, Josh Shapiro, riding the train in Virginia with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Abigail Spanberger running for governor there in Virginia. And pimping the Wawa. And look, I get it. People are in this Wawa sheets. Gotta pick a side. I'm not there. I don't get it. I'm never gonna probably get it because I prefer the guy down the road who owns the place is actually there. That's what I prefer. But anyway, here a week, big elections in New Jersey, Virginia. Gonna decide. A couple of governors racing. Here to share some thoughts on those races, I've asked Sam Newton to come talk with us. Sam is the comms director there at the Democratic Governors Association, the DGA. Sam, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for having me on. And I know we got a lot to discuss with this election in a week, whether it's sheets, Wawa, or electing a governor who's going to fight for local jobs.
No, look, I understand why the Wawa in Virginia. I do, because there are no sheets in Virginia. Makes perfect sense. I get it from the political part. But, you know, I'm a policy guy. I want to know what you're going to do. I want to know what policies you're going to bring, how you're going to help with health care, how you're going to help with wages, how you're going to, all of that stuff. And look, I love Josh. He's doing a great job in my state of Pennsylvania. Just thought it was interesting riding the train, you know, talking about Wawa.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a good thing that Governor Shapiro was down there because these two races in Virginia and New Jersey are going to be the first two big electoral tests of Trump 2.0. And in Virginia, we have a competitive high-stakes race where Abigail Spanberger, a former federal law enforcement officer, former CIA agent, mom of three kids in public schools, and former member of Congress, is running on affordability. Exactly what you talked about. You're saying, hey, I want people are going to tell me what you're going to do. Abigail Spanberger has been running on the economy every single day in this race. She's the only candidate talking about the economy. She's got plans to lower the cost of healthcare, your housing, and your energy. And that's such a big deal because we know Trump got promised on the he got elected on a promise to lower costs, but costs have been going up. and it's a bunch of garbage. And Winsome Sears, the Republican, has done absolutely nothing to distance herself from Trump, even as he attacks local jobs, local health care, and costs continue to go up.
I got to imagine, though, that with the government being shut down, this, especially being Virginia, that this has got to be a central issue in this. Or am I reading that wrong?
It is definitely something that is top of mind for voters down the stretch. We actually released a poll not too long ago that showed that, and it's not surprising because Republicans are in control of the White House, the Senate, the House, and voters in Virginia blame Republicans for the shutdown, and Republicans aren't doing anything to come to the table with Democrats to negotiate a deal to lower healthcare costs. And our poll showed that what's even more unpopular is Donald Trump using the shutdown to fire even more federal workers. It's really just been DOGE 2.0. DOGE 1.0 was already a disaster for Virginia's economy. Unemployment has continued to rise. You're seeing people lose jobs. And Winsome Sears, the Republican, she said, oh, it's not a huge deal. You know, everybody loses their job. We talked about this before, Rick. When you lose your job, it's a big deal. And Abigail Spanberger is running for governor to stand up for Virginia jobs and to lower costs.
Yeah. No, I mean, when somebody else loses a job, oh, it's bad. But when you lose yours, it's the end of the world in a lot of cases. And Virginia is, for me, an interesting place because, you know, they're truly a swing state in that, you know, Glenn Youngkin fortunately can't run for a second term. We've had Democratic governors. There's an opportunity here, especially, you know, with this being a legislative year. There's an opportunity to make Virginia kind of a blue state, no?
Yeah, Virginia's always been a bellwether. And again, I think that goes back to why this race is so important. Right now, we have 23 Democratic governors across the country. They represent a majority of the U.S. population. These are leaders who are waking up every day, focused on improving education, protecting health care, lowering costs, and standing up to the chaos in D.C., as Trump continues to attack our fundamental freedoms and the rule of law. And right now, Virginia has a Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, who's been useless. And there's an opportunity for us to flip that state. And we have another really competitive race in New Jersey. And if we win both of these, we'll have 24 Democratic governors, which I think wouldn't be too bad right now.
You know, I got to tell you, I would love to see Democrats take Virginia, and I would love to see them move on some labor legislation where they hadn't in the past. I would love to see them go after, you know, like right to work or something like that to ensure that working people get a fair shot. Has that been an issue in this campaign at all?
You know, it's certainly come up. And I think Abigail Spanberger has been incredibly clear that she will be a governor who is good for working people, talking about raising the minimum wage and lowering costs, lowering the cost of healthcare, housing, and energy. And she's going to be a governor who wakes up and fights for working families every single day. And I'll tell you what, know who's going to be really bad for working families? Winsome Sears. She doesn't care if you lose your job. She doesn't care if you lose your healthcare. She doesn't care about these costs going up. And I got to say, Trump's big, beautiful bill, which is going to rip healthcare away from thousands of people across Virginia, it's already closed 3 rural health clinics. And this might sound simple, but that is a huge deal. If you are in a small town or in a rural community where there's only one, you know, one big rural healthcare center, when that closes, the doctors and nurses leave, the local economy takes a hit, and then you have to drive hours to get the care you need, or you have to drive your parents or your kids hours to get the care they need, or even worse, you don't get the care at all. And she's supported Trump's big, beautiful bill every step of the way, no matter how much damage it's caused to Virginia. And that's what's going to be on the ballot in a week.
Now, as I understand, the polling has Abigail Spanberger up. I think last I saw was seven points. Is that accurate?
You know, the poll, there's all sorts of varying polls, some by more, some closer. I think we're at the point in this race where you just got to go out and you got to vote. You got to knock on doors. You got to text your friends. You got to make the phone calls. And that's exactly what Abigail Spanberger is doing. She's been on her bus tour called the Virginia Votes Bus Tour, yes, with Governor Shapiro, and traveling around the entire state, or the Commonwealth rather, and talking about her vision to help people lower costs and how she's going to stand up to Trump, who's ripping away jobs.
Let's move over to New Jersey, a big governor's race there as well, as you've got Mikey Sherrill and yep. Jack Citarelli. Walk me through some of the key issues there, because this one is interesting to me, because New Jersey is a solidly blue state in my view, And yet there's some talk that this this Citrulli guy has maybe an outside shot. Am I reading that right?
Well, we always knew this was going to be a competitive race. And to your point, New Jersey is a state that tends to vote blue and Democratic on the federal level. But when it comes down to the state level, it's a state that's gone back and forth roughly every 8 years. And so we have an opportunity to make history by electing, with Democrats winning three consecutive terms for the first time in 60 years. And a lot of people forget the governor's race 4 years ago was only decided by a handful, by a few points. And so Jack Citrulli is running again. We have an opportunity to make him a three-time loser. And the contrast in this race boils down to Mikey Sherrill's for Jersey and Jack Citrulli's for Trump. And speaking of the shutdown, it's a great example of that. The Gateway Tunnel Project. That is a huge job creator in Jersey. It was a huge bipartisan win for the state. It was going to help transportation, jobs, local economy. Trump's going after it. He's trying to eliminate it just, for his own politics. And Jack Citrulli doesn't care.
What's interesting to me is, I lived through the whole Biden term where Biden shut down the Keystone XL pipeline, which cost in reality cost about 200 jobs. And I'm not poo-pooing that away. 200 jobs or 200 families, and I understand that. But the Revolution Wind project that was shut down by Trump was thousands. Fortunately, that's back up and running. As you pointed out, the tunnel project, potentially thousands. The energy programs across this country, thousands. So to have someone who's aligned with that kind of messaging, especially in your backyard where, look, that tunnel is so desperately needed between Jersey and New York. It should be a no-brainer that he comes out and forcefully talks about the administration, at least opening that portion back up, no?
You would think. Trump was supposed to be the guy who builds stuff, and now he's tearing things down, he's killing jobs, he's raising costs, and Jack Citrulli won't stand up to him at all. He has zero backbone. That's why he's a two-time loser, and that's why we're going to make him a three-time loser. And it's a huge contrast with Mikey Sherrill. She's a former prosecutor, Navy helicopter pilot, was a member of Congress who worked across the aisle, and now she's running for governor to make life better for people in New Jersey. And she has two plans that I think are really interesting. The first is her affordability plan, where she's talked a ton about lowering energy costs, which is a huge issue. And the second one is her Save You Time and Money plan, which, not too different from where Governor Shapiro's had a lot of success in Pennsylvania, is talking about making the government work faster and more efficiently for people every single day. And it's not garbage like DOGE, where you're just going to indiscriminately fire a bunch of people. It's about making something actually work faster to improve people's lives.
It's interesting. You mentioned her military background. And I couldn't help but think of my congressman, Scott Perry, former head of the Freedom Caucus, who said that Democrats only serve in the military to get credentials, that they don't really love the country and they don't really want to. It's just to check a box. They're not real patriots. Is that something that you think is useful in this election?
I want to say very clearly, I'm a Democrat. I work for Democrats. We love America. The Democrats, Mikey Sherrill and Abigail Spanberger, who are running for governor, are patriots. They both served our country. Abigail Spanberger in the CIA going after terrorists. Mikey Sherrill in the Navy. These are two incredible leaders with a strong record of service. They've always put our country first. And that means at time putting politics aside, they've shown they've worked across the aisle to get things done. And that's why they're running for office. And these Republicans, I think it's just disgusting when they try to politicize the military like that.
So let me ask you, as the comms director there at the Democratic Governors Association, how are you guys helping these two candidates? And what's the benefit, really? I mean, you talked a moment ago, you got 23 Democratic governors. How would another Democratic governor or two, how is that going to help move the country in a better direction, especially in this age of Trump's attacks on states' rights and on the states going especially blue states? How do you see that working out?
Well, thank you so much for the question. First, at the DGA or the Democratic Governors Association, we are the only national organization committed to electing and reelecting Democratic governors. and we're pretty good at it. We have 23 Democratic governors, and 5 out of the 7 presidential swing states were led by the Democratic governors of 2 deep red states in Kansas, with our chair, Governor Kelly, and our vice chair in Kentucky, Governor Andy Beshear. And we work with these campaigns hand in hand to make sure they're, you know, reaching voters, that they are running the best possible campaigns they can. And we also make significant investments to make sure that voters hear their message. And in New Jersey, a group that we're backing called Greater Garden State has invested over $20 million to ensure that we win New Jersey this year. And in Virginia, we've invested over $7 million in Abigail Spanberger's campaign. And the reason that's so important is because when you get a Democratic governor, the people in that state get an executive who's going to wake up every day and try to make their life better. That means lowering the cost of healthcare, expanding healthcare, improving public education, which is always one of the most important issues at a time when Republicans are trying to defund public schools, fighting for good paying jobs, raising the minimum wage. Really, with the gridlock in DC and Republicans in full control of the federal government, if you want leaders who are going to wake up and actually make progress, Democratic governors are really your best bet. And not only do they know how to win, they know how to deliver. And that's why it's so important.
Well, but come on, Sam, you know, the Democrats don't have a bench. You know, I saw my Teamsters Union president, Sean O'Brien, on some podcast talking about the Democratic Party's pool is shallow. And I look at, you know, Josh Shapiro, I look at Spanberger, I look at a number of these folks. I don't know that shallow is the right word.
I think Democratic governors are the future of the party. And if you are an American who is worried about where the Democratic Party should go, how are we going to get things done, look no further to the states and the Democratic governors who know how to win. And then they actually govern and work across the aisle to get things done. In Arizona, a state that Donald Trump just won last year, Governor Katie Hobbs has canceled medical debt for thousands of people in Arizona. That is a huge difference. She's eliminated the tax on rent. She is working to make communities safer. She worked with Republicans to protect abortion rights. That would have never happened if we had a Republican governor in Arizona. A Republican governor would be going after public schools and would be going after health care and trying to ban abortion. Same Michigan, another great example. Governor Whitmer has gotten so much done, investing in community college, fixing the damn roads, repealing this really unfair retirement tax that was really hurting working people and seniors. And so it's really more important than ever that we elect Democratic governors. And I think they are showing a path forward for our entire party.
How come we're not hearing that message more? Because look, all I keep getting from people is, you know, Democrats only care about which bathroom people go to. How come I'm not hearing that economic message? They're the party of going to lower costs. They're the party that is getting things done. States that have gone after labor law reform. How come we're not hearing more of that stuff and really pushing that as a central issue and central messaging for the party?
We absolutely need to be talking about the economy every single day, whether you went to college, whether you didn't get to college. Every person deserves the skills and the opportunity to go wake up and earn a good living for their family and to move ahead. And that's what Democratic governors are doing. A lot of our governors talk about that every day. You know, we're working really hard to make sure that it's breaking through. Governor Kelly in Kansas, she won re-election in 2022 by talking about axing the food tax. Governor Beshear won a top re-election in 2023 by talking about jobs and the economy and showing up everywhere and talking about that every single day. And so we need to be doing more of it, because I think you and I know Trump got elected on a promise to lower costs. He's going to be great for the economy, and he's been a disaster. And it is a huge opportunity for Democrats up and down the ballot to go on offense on the economy and be the party that's talking about jobs, lowering costs, and delivering for families. And just to bring it full circle, that's what Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Scher are doing. And that's why it's so important we elect them in a week.
Yeah, last question I've got for you. Obviously in a week, the people are going to go to the polls and someone's going to win, somebody's going to lose. Why is it important that those two states, New Jersey and Virginia, vote for the Democratic candidate?
Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Scher will be governors who always put the people of their states first. They'll work across the aisle with anyone to make your life better. And then when someone like Donald Trump tries to make your life worse, they will stand up and they will fight back. Their North Star is putting working people first, working families first, and helping people get ahead. And that's why it's so important that we elect them in a week.
There you go. Sam Newton, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good stuff as always. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon, especially if you pick up both these seats, because I think we desperately need it. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Good stuff, Sam Newton there, the communications director there at the Democratic Governors Association. Check out their website, democraticgovernors.org. Want to hear your thoughts. If you're in Jersey or in Virginia, which way are you going? I want to hear it. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. And what issues and messages are actually getting through to you? I want to hear that. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1861. That was the day that the Pony Express made its last run and passed into legend. The mail delivery service had lasted only a year and a half until it folded under competition from the newly completed Transcontinental Telegraph. The idea for a faster Western mail delivery service came from the owners of the wagon freight company, Russell, Majors & Waddell. At the time, the railroad terminated in St. Joseph, Missouri. The goal of the Pony Express route was to cover the 2,000-mile route from St. Joe to San Francisco in 10 days, or half the time of competitors. Riders would travel between one station and another on horseback, switching horses as they went. For this arduous job, the company targeted young men, sometimes in their teens. The goal was to hire small men to keep the weight low for the horses. The riders had to sign a pledge not to drink, gamble, fight, or swear. To back up the clean living, they were each issued a Bible. Riders were paid a minimum of $50 per month in addition to room and board. The riders faced many hazards from bad weather to thieves. They often traveled across lands in dispute between the U.S. government and Native Americans, adding to the potential danger. The fastest express delivery ever was Lincoln's inaugural address, which made it to California in under 8 days. Perhaps the most famous person who claimed to be a Pony Express rider was Buffalo Bill Cody, although it's unlikely he ever carried the mail. He incorporated the Pony Express into his Wild West show, turning the mail service into the stuff of legend. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It'll be interesting to see what happens over the next week. And I look at this next story kind of as the October surprise for people in New Jersey. And really, this is the latest outrage, and it's really a slap in the face, pure and simple. Health insurance premiums in the state, through the state exchange, are about to skyrocket by, according to Politico, 175% next year. That's not some far off nightmare. It's going to happen because of one thing, one reason. There's only one reason for this. It's called Republicans. That's simple. And the fact that Jack Citrulli is even close, anywhere near being able to be elected in that state with this in mind, is quite remarkable. Because the Trump administration and Republicans have chosen to do this because of their refusal to extend the subsidies for the health insurance that was made more affordable because of Biden's policy. And the only reason they want to do away with it is because it was Biden's policy. And again, this is more of the kind of cruelty that you can expect from Republican governance. This is more the kind of cruelty that you expect from Trump and this kind of political gamesmanship. Because look, these enhanced subsidies were put in place under the Biden administration, which is why they're 100% opposed to it. But it actually helped people. It helped people keep coverage without having to choose to pay the bills or for groceries or to go uninsured. But guess what? You got Trump and the Republicans who have tied these life-saving subsidies to a government shutdown fight and refusing to extend them unless, you know, we give more. So what's going to happen? Well, I guess, according to this report, over 500,000 New Jerseyans who rely on these subsidies are going to see their rate hikes of what was the number? $2,700, almost $2,800 bucks a year for people who are the working poor, the working. And understand, if this happens to them, everybody along the economic ladder, you're going to get hit too. This doesn't just happen to those people. And the state's own meager subsidy program is not going to be able to fill the gap, which means there are going to be a lot of people without insurance, which means uncompensated care, because they're not going to stop getting sick. People are still going to be going to the hospital, still, you know, using the emergency room. And that's going to do one of two things. It's going to raise the rates for everyone else, and it's going to cause a lot of places to shut down. That's simple. Understand, New Jersey's subsidy fund is less than half of what the federal government was providing. So again, we know working families, seniors, the people who depend on Get Covered New Jersey, well, they're going to end up bearing the brunt of the pain. But everyone's going to get clipped in this. And in Trenton, you've got some Democrats who say they can't cover the costs either. And that the blame goes where? Squarely on the shoulders of Republican obstructionism. That's where we are. That's what's going on. And again, I come back to this. These aren't just numbers. These are real people, real lives. And they're being squeezed by politicians who, again, it's about the ideology. It's about the party. It's about dear leader. So you could look at this as some kind of horrendous October surprise. And it is. It's a clear demonstration of Trump and Republicans, their recklessness holding healthcare hostage for their political gamesmanship, while working class folks, they're again going to take the brunt of the pain and the struggle. And this is going to go, it's not about red hat or blue hat, because I know a lot of Republicans who get their healthcare through ACA type programs. And I look at this and go, you know, this governor's race is kind of a big deal. Because, you know, if the Republican gets in, they're just going to gut the rest of it so they can give tax cuts to the very wealthy. And that means even more people will go uninsured, which, again, that snowball of horrible, more uninsured people, more uncompensated care, more hospitals either having to write off or pass costs along to everyone else, and rising costs for everybody else. It's quite remarkable, but it is where we are. And this isn't just New Jersey. New Jersey's under the microscope right now because they got a gubernatorial race coming up in a week. And however that goes means, well, you're going to have either more uninsured or not. An advocate who's going to fight for states to get the resources they need to help take care of their citizens or not. A Trump sycophant or not. And this is sadly where we've come in all of this. So for me, New Jersey is going to be an interesting watch, because, you know, as Sam pointed out, they do have a history of Republican governors, some really bad ones. I think of Christy Todd Whitman. I think of Chris Christie. Going to be interesting. This guy, this Jack Ciccarelli, I see as worse than both of those two combined. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you're in Jersey or in Virginia, I want to hear which way the wind's blowing in your world. What are you hearing? What are you seeing? What are you hoping? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. For those around the rest of the world, I want to hear your thoughts too. Are you happy with where we're going? Happy with the way the country is leading? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
We're a civic media station.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Stacy Lynn. Hurricane Melissa hit Jamaica earlier today as a catastrophic Category 5 storm. Winds were 185 miles per hour. The damage from the rain, flooding, and wind is expected to be extensive. Wayne Todd and his new wife have been holed up at a resort in Negril on their honeymoon.
They've made sure to give us plenty of rations. We get plenty of water and food in our rooms. They've been bringing us meals.
The hurricane's now a Category 3 with powerful 125-mile-per-hour winds. CBS's Jason Allen reports from Kingston.
This hurricane came on shore hours ago, and things have not gotten any better. And consider that we are 75, 80 miles to the east of where Melissa made landfall. There's been a noticeable change in temperature here, much, much cooler here on the backside of this storm.